The field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong. Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train. Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena, June Feld, and Ellis Starr.
And welcome back to the Horse Racing Radio Network, and welcome into the final furlong show, our Trainer Talk edition, every Wednesday night, and looking forward to tonight's show. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, and the Uber Capper Ellis Starr. We are all with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios here on HRRN and getting ready for a big Trainer Talk show. This is the show that trainers listen to, and it's all presented by Bullet Train, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. And our very first guest of the evening is trainer Kelly Breen. He will be followed in the second half of the show by Mike Machowski. But Kelly, nice enough to spend some time with us here tonight. He has trained 445 winners for his career, and he has tasted success at the top level of this game, conditioning 2011 Belmont Stakes winner, Ruler on Ice. And Kelly, thanks for spending some time with us here this evening.
Can you hear me, guys?
Yeah.
We got you. Can you hear us?
Okay. Everything sounds good here.
All right, good. How you doing?
Very good.
Thanks for taking the time to be here with us tonight. We appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, listen, you sound like you're in your car. Are you driving?
I'm in my car, yes. I'm going to take my son to see the Florida Panthers, go for a hockey practice.
Oh, cool.
Oh, you get to watch the practice tonight?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool that they let you in there to do that.
It's kind of like watching the workouts for... You know, maybe we'll see what the line is on Saturday night to see if they're ready or not.
There you go.
Is your son a hockey player?
Yeah, he plays a little bit.
How old is he?
Short now. How old are you, buddy? Eight. He's eight.
Yeah, you need to know that question, right? That's one of those easy ones. I started you off with a softball, Kelly. Hey, well, listen, this show, Kelly, very much about you and how you got started and, you know, much more about your background than necessarily the specific horses that you have in training right now. So take us back to the beginning and tell us how Kelly Breen got hooked on horse racing.
My family has nothing to do with horse racing. We lived about 20 miles north of Monmouth Park. We used to go a couple times during the summer. I grew up as a small kid in my class, one of the smallest. You know, when you go from either weight or height, I was either the first or the second guy growing up. Being very intrigued with the horses, I'm an animal lover. Just started saying, you know, maybe I should start riding horses. I could be a jockey. This looked like awful, you know, fun. That, you know, I was very much a competitor, wanting to win at everything that I did, and you could do something and get paid for it and love it. Sounded pretty good to me.
Were you always athletic?
Yes. Yeah. I for the smallest guy on the team, I was a captain of this soccer team. I played baseball. I wrestled, and I didn't like to lose.
Paul LaDuke has said today that was the great thing about baseball. You could be any shape or size and do well.
Yeah. You know, I'm getting into a little bit of golf right now, and it's sometimes hard to measure up your opponent because, same thing, you could be a little bit, not in the best of physical condition, but you can hit that ground ball and you can putt. You know, you can beat people that you don't have to really look like an athlete.
Yeah, look at Tom Proctor.
If you don't like to lose, give up golf right now. Trust me, there's no winning at golf. It's impossible.
Yeah, I do pretty good for myself.
What's your handicap?
Probably about a 6.
Wow.
Wow.
Good.
Yeah, we won't be playing with you when I come to Florida.
Yeah. So if you want to play, I'll give you one aside, and Yeah, well, you do.
Bring your wallet. We'll be...
You better bring some balls.
Yeah. Yeah. Was he talking about one ball aside? Or... Yeah. Well, Kelly, so what was the first time you remember going to the racetrack then?
Well, I think that, you know, back then, one of the big things that I had that probably made me as much energetic about the horse racing was gambling. And I used to get $6 for two races at Monmouth Park. $6 for the fourth race and $6 for the last race, and bet a $1 trifecta box with three horses. And, you know, you do it a couple of times and you figure out that you learn about odds right away. You learn to try and handicap. And I remember one day the favorites came in 1, 2, 3 in both races. I hit both trifectas, and I walked out of there with about $240. And I was like, this horse racing is the greatest thing since sliced bread. So I know I started out with gambling as a, you know, young age, and part of it had to do with winning. And it was very addictive.
When did you decide that you wanted to become a trainer?
You know, I had turned 16, and I had, to say, grew probably, 6 or 7 inches in a couple of months. And I went from 5 foot to 5'6", 5'7", or close to what I am now, 5'8". And all my pants were up to my shins. And I was working for a guy that, at the time, he had been one of the guys to help motivate Chris Antley with Walter Reese. And he had helped with apprentice jockeys, that sort of thing. And I was working for him, and I couldn't keep the weight. No matter what I did, I used to just eat granola bars all day. I didn't have anything, and maybe had some steamed vegetables for dinner. And when it's inevitable, it's inevitable. You can't, genetics is genetics. And I just got too big. So by the time I was 17, somewhere around 17, turning 18, I started getting on some horses for Scooter Dickey. And at that young of an age, Scooter says, I see what you're going through. I need an assistant trainer. You want to go out to Arkansas with me and, make good money? So when you're that young and you're offered an assistant job and you're offered good money, I was like, this is pretty good. I dabbled a little bit with my parents, my father, my brother, did construction in Manhattan, were steam fitters, and fixing air conditioning units, sprinkler systems in Manhattan. I worked in the World Trade Center, Twin Towers, you name it, I'd been there. And that was just kind of like a side job sort of thing for a couple of years. And it came to a point where I had to make a decision between going to work with my dad or work with horses. And it was kind of neat to build things, to make things, and start from scratch and putting in the whole sprinkler system on a floor of a new building or something like that. But it wasn't winning. And even when I went to work with my father, on the weekends I went back and I was still galloping horses. That's where my heart was at. And I went from there to saying, I think I can pull this off and make enough money training some horses. That was kind of like the deciding factor as to, what was I going to do? Was I going to be a construction worker, or was I going to try and train horses? At that young of an age, I'm going to give it all that I can to try and be a trainer.
Who is the best horse that you ever galloped?
I had been on some nice horses. When I went to work for Ben Perkins Sr., I was his assistant, and a couple of the horses went to be stallions. I probably would say the most recognized one was Forest Wildcat. He was just fast, extremely fast horse. Being on a couple of nice horses, I'd been on maybe to say I had been on Ruler on Ice, who's my own. I've slowed down getting on horses. I've actually just in the past week had to go to the hospital for having a bad back. So I am fixated on getting on horses right now. I'm sort of in a little bit of depression right now. Friday it happened to me where I was at the barn and I have a couple of bulging discs and a tear in my back that I was bedridden on Saturday and, you know, back to the barn on Sunday, but not. I'm moving awfully cautiously right now.
Well, that's always a sad day when you can't get on your own horses. That's not a feeling I ever had at my weight, but I know when I gave up riding the pony, it wasn't much fun either. I know what you're going through. When you started out as an assistant, did anything, you know, kind of scary about going out on your own, or were you gung-ho from the start?
I had a big push from my wife's cousin, who worked in Wall Street, and said, I got some guys, and we want to claim a horse, and we want to do this. And, you know, there's a tough process, you know, especially someone saying that they're not really an insider. You're not grown up around the racetrack where you have your uncle or somebody that's there. I literally knew nobody at the racetrack. You can't get a trainer's license without a horse. You can't get a horse without a trainer's license. So I have a New York Wall Street guy telling me, you know, you've given me some winners. I like to buy a horse, and I want you to train it. And then all of a sudden you go through all this, you know, red tape. How am I going to get a horse? And it was mostly a big push through. A fellow's name is Ricky Gallo, and I've trained for him for years. He was a motivating force into me getting horses. And, you know, he really was the one. He made me get my trainer's license, put it that way.
Kelly, when you look back at the people that helped you along the way, you mentioned working for Ben Perkins Sr. Would he be the person that helped you the most, or were there other people that had a hand in that?
Well, I had worked for John Forbes, who was the leading trainer at Monmouth Park for years. And when it got to Monmouth Park, I was freelance and getting on a couple of horses here, a couple of horses there, and training one or two of my own horses. And I had gotten up to a point where I had a couple winners. I was at Monmouth Park. It's my home base. And I had four horses. I started out the meet with like two horses. Ended the meet with six horses. I think I had 16 starts, four wins, three seconds, two thirds. And I thought I had the world by the ball. You know, I was like, hey, I'm winning races, and I get a good percent, and everything's doing great. And Ben Perkins was kind of coming out of retirement and had Evie Novak, with New Farm, sort of getting into the business. Ben said, I need a good assistant, took me out for breakfast, and it was kind of like, you know, a little bit of a godfather. I'm going to offer you something that you can't refuse. And I was kind of like, at the same time, I had my wife's cousin saying, maybe we'll buy more horses, and I thought that it was a turning point in my life, and I said, I don't think I'm ready. You know, I have cheaper horses. I have a man telling me, I'm going to teach you how to train stake horses. You know, I'm messing around with $5,000 claimers. We're going to work. You know, I have good horses, and I'd like you to be my assistant. And he paid me well. Was pretty much, you know, he and I, we were a very good combination. I learned for many years. And then I think at the same time, maybe halfway through it, I worked for him for about 6 years, maybe about halfway through it, I got to put in a little bit of my two cents and saying, hey, Mr. Ben, how about this? And he was getting a little bit older, and we were training at different tracks. He lived down in South Jersey. At points, we went to Delaware when they first got slot machines. And I was a lot of his eyes, and he would ask me questions about the horses. And I would give him my opinion, and he took my opinion pretty seriously, and we won a lot of races. And, you know, he groomed me into being a nice trainer without really noticing that he was probably grooming me. You know, he probably, you know, might have Miyagi'd me a little bit, as just saying, this is what I want you to do. And you know, to see some of the gleam in his eye when we had horses, like a breeze day, we would breeze a lot of horses on a Saturday morning. Saturday morning, there's times where it would be tough to feed him to the barn because he'd be all excited about getting some of these top horses, you know, working them out against each other and seeing how far we're going to go and what we're going to do and listening to his instructions. You know, it motivated me, and I've gotten to be the same way where if I know, like this Sunday, I'm going to work Burn Identity, I can't wait for Sunday to happen. It's going to be 6 days out from the Holy Bowl, and I know I got to run against Shanghai Bobby, but it's going to be, you know, I'll be thinking a lot of different things about while I'm sleeping on Saturday night.
Well, you went, you know, looks like, Kelly, you got a great tutelage under Mr. Perkins. And at what point did you decide it was time to, that you were ready and it was time to go back on your own?
I never thought I was ready. It was Mr. Perkins had a bout with colon cancer, and he said that, you know, I'm not going to, I'm trying to remember his age, but he's in his late 70s, and he has a son who's 50 years old. He says, I'm going to give the horses to my son. You know, you can go be an assistant for him. But at the time, he actually didn't tell me about his health problems. He just said that, you know, he's getting a little older and he's going to step down. At that point, I kind of said to myself, I had my wife just had a baby, and I'm trying to figure out what am I going to do. You know, I know it's not going to be the same. I said, maybe this is a sign that I'm going to try and do this on my own. And it's we struggled, you know, trying to get horses, trying to get different owners, and maybe not having the golden tongue like Mr. Perkins had of talking to people. And, you know, I'm not that great of a solicitor. You know, I can't just walk to you and tell you, you know, hey, let me take that horse and I'm going to win the Kentucky Derby for you. That's not my way of talking. You know, I go to work early, I work hard, I try and win races, I think I know what I'm doing. You know, when I say a horse is going to run good, they usually run good. You know, maybe not lately. I'm in a little bit of a drought right now, but you have your ups and downs, you try and ride with the tide. But I think that the whole thing of Ben retiring, you know, put me on my own and saying, you know, hey, you got to stand on your own feet now.
Well, and Kelly, it's been a meteoric rise for you. By the way, Kelly Breen joining us here on Trainer Talk presented by Bullet Train here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It has been a meteoric rise, and you've been to the top now, winning the Belmont Stakes with Ruler on Ice in 2011. Is it true when you call your cell phone that it's Frank Sinatra singing New York, New York as your ringtone?
Yeah, I had that for a year, and my wife is extremely cheap, and she said when that year is up, you're not going to pay for that anymore.
Come on. You won the Belmont Stakes.
It's tough. You know, I try not to argue with it too much, but there's certain things that I know that I can't win. So I'm lucky that, you know, down in South Florida right now, on the regular cable channels, you can get the HRTV. And I said, I have to have this channel. I said, they don't show Gulfstream from any other channel down here. And she says, so you can get it for free on a computer. So I was, you know, this is what I'm dealing with to try and figure out. I know I get to listen to you guys on channel 209, and that's only because I had a polar leg saying that, you know, that my thing on the car, the Sirius radio, ran out and I need the sports package. I have a lot of losing battles as to what I get to do and what I can and can't do.
You got to pick your spots, huh?
Yes.
Well, we appreciate the loyalty.
Kelly, what do you remember when you look back on that Belmont Stakes? What's the first thing that pops into your mind?
You know, that one of the best things for me, and being from New Jersey, was that a lot of my family was there. My mother has been sick. She couldn't make it, but my father made it. My brother made it. My sister made it. And they're not usually, not to say fans, but they don't come to big races. Or, you know, when I went to the first time I went to the Kentucky Derby, it was a bigger deal for, you know, locals from New Jersey to go to Kentucky for the Kentucky Derby. So part of it was my family. The other part of it was, you know, I think going back to gambling was that we all bet on them. You know, it wasn't like we went in there and said, now we have a long shot and let's, you know, keep our fingers crossed. We went in there and I told everybody, you know, it was, we got out of the paddock and George says, what do you think? I says, George, I bet. And I you know, have sure, my pocket money is with my wife around. She's like, really? And I said, yeah. And, you know, I get an opportunity about twice or three times a year where I tell my wife that I'm going to make a little wager that she gets me spending money. So with 10 minutes to post, George handed me a knot of money, and he says, bet for me, too. So I think part of saying that you're going to do it, running in a big race, doing it, cashing a ticket, having your family there, you know, a Triple Crown race. Could have been a beer commercial, but it didn't get much better than that.
And if I recall, you cheered so hard you had to go to the doctor afterwards, right?
I lost my voice for about, I'm going to say, 6 weeks.
Wow.
I was waiting for it to come back, and when it never came back, the local doctor that we have at works at Monmouth Park, Angelo Chinichi, he says, I'm going to send you to a specialist. He says, you really sound like crap. So when I did go to the specialist, and the guy says, you know, your vocal cord, the thing is vocal cord goes down and looks like the point of a piece of paper. He says, yours is as round as a bowling ball. So he says, you're going to need some medication, some anti-inflammatories, some prednisolone, so-and-so. And he says, and try not to talk. Not that easy.
Yeah, that's bad news for a horse trainer, not being able to talk, huh?
Yeah. So,
Kelly, when you look back on your career, obviously Ruler on Ice is going to hold a special place for you. What are some of the other horses that you're going to look back on and never forget?
I believe to say, and he just run it the other day, their homebred was that won our first, you know, to say Derby, the Louisiana Derby, was Pants on Fire. That was another day where horse was doing good. I was at the track. I'm not too familiar with fairgrounds, and I sat in a corner with a bunch of fans. A couple of the guys looked like they were just right out of the Blues Parade, you know, all suited up, and you know, and I win the race, and I'm jumping, I'm hugging these two guys, and they're like, you bet? And I said, I bet. I said, that's my horse. And they were like, you're kidding me, you know. So the other horse I'd say that was a horse named Contarito was my very first horse. I have his halter up on my wall with a sign from Ricky Gallo, who had my first owner, and it says, this is where it all began. You know, so there's plenty of horses that are, you know, going to be sentimental in my heart. First horse, first you know, Derby winner, to say a Louisiana Derby, and first Triple Crown winner. And I like to say this, you know, first, because I hope that I'm doing this long enough and I'll have multiples.
Yeah, no, that's good. I don't know if anybody's told you before, but your story parallels Bobby Frankel's story quite a bit with the gambling and working on the track and giving some winners out. And that's kind of how Bobby started training horses back in the day, and it's been very interesting to listen to that unfold, because it's familiar to me.
Well, I can tell you one thing. It was a tough road, you know, to try and solicit people for being somebody that doesn't really solicit people, to try and know that you're, not to say down and out, but your horse has got to start winning money when you own some of them, or, you know, we're going to be eating a lot of potatoes. That was the truth of it. And, you know, there's a couple of certain times in my life where, you know, you have a reality check. You know, the industry right now, it seems like every time that I have a child, that the business or something's going on in my life. And right now we got the business being on under the microscope. My wife, for is due in March, and she's like, you know, I don't know to say that my eldest is 13, my son is 8, and now here I am with my third one, and she's saying, boy, this is a crazy world we're having to bring another kid into, and you know that between the industry is under the microscope, what's going on with our home track, a mom and park. And I said, you know what? All I could do is wake up every morning and go to work and hope that everything that I'm doing works and we win races.
Laz Barrera told me when you have a kid, you go on a winning streak. So all you got to do is ride it out till March and you'll be okay.
Okay. I hope so. I hope that I can raise a little kid in a winner's circle in a Kentucky Derby this year. That would be awesome.
Well, Kelly, look, you've always been a class act, and you've always been great to us. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show here tonight. We really enjoyed spending some time with you. We have about 30 seconds left. Very quickly, one of our listeners tweeted in and asked us about those plans for Burn Identity and wanted to know how he's doing.
He's doing awesome. He really does good. On the undercard of the day, I'm going to run another horse named Duke of the City who's been working with him. He's going to run an allowance race. Burn Identity is just tearing up the track. Looks awesome. I'm hoping to have a really good day next Saturday.
Oh. Well, Kelly, we are too. We'll be cheering for you, and all the best with Burn Identity, and we'll look forward to seeing you when we get down there.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Great stuff from Kelly Breen. What a visit.
Yeah, no, that was
cool. Such a character,
isn't he? Yeah, great guy.
Yeah, awesome story.
Good story.
Yeah, great story.
Yeah.
Great story. Good stuff, Kelly Breen. Looking forward to the second half as well. Mike Machowski, going to be another fun visit here in the second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. We're back with that right after this break.
You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train. It's time to get on board.
Group-winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at 2 with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a Group 1. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Monjou and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky, for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
The Wizards Betting Window is now new and improved. Available exclusively at DRF.com, the Wizards Betting Window takes the work out of wagering by giving you just the Wizards' best plays and strongest opinions for wagering recommendations at top tracks around the country. Along with win and plays, the Betting Window includes pick threes, pick fours, and pick sixes, and 10-cent superfectas wherever possible. Both longtime horse players and racing newcomers can benefit from using the Betting Window. It's like no other handicapping sheet in the market. Only the Wizards Betting Window offers real-time changes to reflect late scratches, changing track and weather conditions, late equipment changes, and more. Just download the Betting Window while you do your handicapping in advance and then receive an updated final edition 30 to 60 minutes before the first race post time. The Betting Window final edition will be delivered right to your inbox so you can receive it anywhere you wager. Use the Wizard's best wagering strategies to help maximize your returns. Visit drf.com/wizbw to try the Wizard's Betting Window today. That's drf.com/WizBW.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
Thank you.
Don't miss the Sunshine Millions, live from Gulfstream Park, this Saturday, January 19th. Tune to Sirius Channel 93, Saturday, beginning at 3, as Mike Pena and Jude Feld bring you the 11th annual Sunshine Millions. Last year, Mucho Macho Man ran the mile and an eighth in near record time. Who will take the Sunshine Millions Classic this year? Tune in Saturday to find out. It's the Sunshine Millions, right here on HRRN. You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train, it's time to get on board.
Welcome back to the Final Furlong Show, a Trainer Talk edition on this Wednesday night here on HRRN. Mike Pena, Jude Feld, Ella Starr, our producer Lee Delapina. We are with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and a fun visit in the first half of the show with trainer Kelly Breen, and really looking forward to our next special guest. That's Mike Machowski, who has trained more than 450 winners, actually 451, the exact number of winners trained by Mike Machowski. And Mike is joining us now live from California. Mike, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Now, Mike, I'm going to get this out of the way right off the bat. And the best horse you ever trained, and if you don't say Rush Rush, we're hanging up the phone right now.
I wish I had no more time with Rush Rush. He could have been one of them. Yeah, too bad he had some injuries, forces retirement, but he was cut out to be a pretty nice long-distance horse.
And for people that don't know, Rush Rush, a horse that Jude and his brothers turned me on to. Jude, you told me to come see him at the farm. I wanted to get involved with a horse and own a piece. I couldn't afford to buy the whole horse. So you said, come on out and take a look at this horse. And I got in through your brother Bob and Bongo Racing. And Mike was the trainer of Rush Rush. And Mike, I can still remember his very first race down the hill at Santa Anita. First horse I ever owned a piece of, his first start. And he comes flying from the back of the pack and wins. And it was the coolest experience ever.
Yeah, no, he was a pretty talented horse because he's meant to run a mile and a half, and any horse that can win first time out going short, they obviously have quite a bit of talent. And he's a pretty fun horse. It's funny you mentioned him because just a couple of days ago I called, text Jude's brother because I have the full papers on Rush Rush still. So if he's so Bob wants him. He's put claim to him the other day.
Yeah, I'm sure he wants him. If he doesn't want him, I know Mike would love to have him framed. Maybe we'll put him here in the studio.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, you guys can bid for him.
Yeah, well, he was a beautiful horse. I used to have him outside my house in the paddock. I liked him so much. And when Mike said he was interested in getting a horse, I said, well, here's this horse is my favorite on the farm, and you should come take a look at him. So you did a great job with him. He was a lot of fun for all of us. We won several races with him, and as usual, first-class job.
And I can imagine for you, being a trainer, that has to be one of the greatest thrills for you because they're kind of like, I don't want to call them your kids, but they kind of become like that. And then you see all the people involved with these horses getting so much enjoyment out of seeing them run well. That has to be a huge thrill for you.
Oh, it is. I mean, the horses are, you know, any trainer, this their life pretty much. You know, we're there 7 days, and we're there whether we have good ones or bad ones, and good weather, bad weather, and it just you truly have to love training horses to be in it, I think.
Well, where did it all start for Mike Machowski? How did you get hooked on horse racing?
Well, I kind of was a degenerate a little bit when I was younger. My father owned some quarter horses, and when I was a young kid, he'd drop me off on the weekends, and I'd go muck stalls or walk hots for Clay Brinson, and then I'd meet him over at the races and stuff like that. That was when I was like 14, and just always enjoyed going to races and started out there. And then I was lucky enough to, you know, when I got out of high school and stuff like that, I got a summer job with Clay. And then I, you know, moved on to, you know, rubbing some horses for Henry Moreno. And then, you know, Tom Walker had that private stable Calumet out here. I worked for him for a while. And then went back to working for Henry. And then Mandela came up and offered me a job one day and kind of got lucky there. And you know, just everything kind of took off from there. And I worked for him for 5.5 years.
Yeah, Richard Mandela, you know, obviously Hall of Fame trainer, excellent horseman, and a very good teacher. He's had a lot of guys go on to future success, of which you're one of the group. But I know Lucas gets a lot of credit for turning out trainers, but Mandela's done a great job as well.
Yeah, I mean, working for him is like being in college, you know, and we didn't get much sleep and worked a lot of hours. And working for him, you have to enjoy and put out. And it's great education, you know, to do what you want to do and try to do it the right way.
Who taught you the most, Mike?
Who taught me the most?
Yeah.
You know, I've kind of taken a lot from all different places I've been and seen. And, you know, but, you know, working for Richard, I was an assistant. So you're going to see a lot more than you are rubbing horses or being a stable foreman, just because you're going to be, you know, dealing with the owners a little bit more and you know, learning a little more different parts of the business that you don't see in other parts of the job. So I would say Richard taught me the most. You know, he was always very stern and, you know, with making decisions and made great decisions, and just kind of learned from that. You learn to admire. And when I went on my own, I kind of caught myself doing a lot of the same things with, you know, the employees or how to communicate and try to, you know, do as good a job you can with the owners and be, you know, very honest and direct with them.
Yeah, Richard's very much runs his stable in a business-like fashion. Talk about that and how important it is to pay attention to the business aspects of training.
Well, you know, the biggest lesson I learned from him, but the first lesson working for Richard is he was out of town in Argentina looking horses for Mr. Hubbard. And I remember we had we got a few horses for Golden Eagle Farms when Mr. Maybe was really rolling back then. He sent a filly down to us named Belle Starlet. And she ended up grabbing a quarter and was supposed to run in the state coming up, and turned out to be a very nice filly. And he, you know, told Dick, I said, you know, this thing's just not looking good and all. And he said, well, call Mr. Maybe, and he's going to try to push you a little bit, but you be stern and you tell him, you know, what's best for the filly. And right then, it kind of, a lot of things clicked, you know, just, you know, doing what's right for the horse, and they're going to get you to the winner's circle more often than not. And you know, just learning from Richard, you know, how to be a horseman and treat owners and treat your help and treat the horses, most importantly, is, you know, I learned a lot there.
Do you still model your operation after his? Is that kind of the structure that you had in place?
Yeah, it's funny. I pulled him up about 5:30 this morning. He didn't want to be too talkative because I was quizzing him on training the horse. I have a horse, you know, I've been dealing with foot issues. Probably is, you know, pretty popular horse. Caracatano, I was quizzing about training barefoot a little bit this morning on him and all that. And, you know, during the winter months, just it gets a little more touchy with, you know, the weather and, you know, horses don't seem to grow enough hoof. And so I was picking his mind. So I pick his mind all the time, bounce things off him.
Well, speaking of Caracatano, Mike, you know, this is a horse I know, like you said, had some issues. And just amazing how you've been able to handle this horse. Is 9 for 19, and he's a fan favorite in Southern California. Tell me a little more about him and about that recent stake win of the Daytona Stakes earlier this month.
Yeah, he's been very fortunate to have a horse like him. He's, you know, he didn't do anything anywhere from sprint to route to turf to dirt to synthetic, and he's just been nice to have. You know, makes my job easier, except for when you're dealing with it ended up being a pretty major foot issue. He won the Daytona, and then I had him back in another stake, and he ended up having a little pus pocket coming out of the kind of this odd spot on the horse where they on the sole of his foot and kind of the cleft of his frog, and ended up being pretty undermined, and it took us a while, and they ended up shedding the frog, which was been the whole so that his whole frog shed off, and then we had a big open gaping, you know, hole there. We had to let that, you know, slowly grow back and fill back in, and it was and with at the same time keeping it clean and so it didn't get infected. It was a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of patience and frustration along with it. And he's finally come around, and I'm just, you know, very cautious. I mean, we missed the Breeders' Cup last year. You know, I had him breezing a little bit at Del Mar, then he had a little pus come out of it again, and then just pretty much shut it down, and just trying to get him over and through it and get a healthy enough hoof on him, and I'm micromanaging the rest of this year, and you know, with Sandy to have the Breeders' Cup again next year, that's my main objective. And with him, he's such a precocious horse, I don't need to do a lot with him to get him there. In any race. I just, you know, I just want to have a healthy and sound horse when it comes next to me in November.
Mike, he's been a fun horse for you, and his story is very interesting. Not only his story about his breeding and his dam, which I'm going to let you tell, but even the story about how he got his name. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, it was, I ended up with his mom could run quite a bit, and I owned a piece of her with a couple clients, and get her up to about 5 weeks a mile. I think we turned out about four different times, and her ankles would start filling up on her, but nothing radiographically would ever be in there. She'd start tying up, and I couldn't get her through that. And about this time, when she was four, I just said, let's breed her, guys. She's got enough talent. And my partners didn't want to breed her, and they said, you breed her. We're in a race. You know, we don't want no brood mare. So I bred her, and first foal ended up, you know, he ended up having a bad knee on him and didn't make him. Second foal's care. And it's funny because Bob Feld has had lots of, you know, he's trying to get the cat dreams going on here. He goes, here, just breed her, you know, breed her to him. So I caught lightning in the bottle there, just breeding her to cat dreams, and here we get him. And then when he's coming from the farm, you know, as a two-year-old, when later, a couple of years down the line, he had a big old scar, I mean, some sutures in his nose, and you still could see the scar there. So I tried to name him Scarface, and the jockey club denied me, so we put it in Spanish. And just kind of, he's got quite the following. I mean, I get emails just from, you know, people on, out of the blue, or, you know, when we ran the Preakness, so there's been emails just from fans, just, you know, they just love the horse. It's kind of a, you know, one of those stories that, you know, came from nowhere, and, you know, that's horse racing. That's a great thing about it.
Yeah, he's been a cool horse, and I think that Preakness experience was a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, we had a great time, didn't we?
Yeah, it was great to have you there, and great to have the horse there, and you know, Preakness is such a great event anyway.
I tell you what, they spoil you over there. They give you anything they need. The way they just treat the help and the owners, and it's in horse racing, you want to do the Preakness. It's one of the things you want to do. I know everybody wants the Derby, but the Preakness is quite a show. We had a great time there.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that Preakness Stakes and bringing Cara Cortado there, Mike, and that whole experience.
And, you know, it's my first time to run into Preakness. The second time I've been there during Preakness week, I was there a few years earlier with Southern Image for the Pimlico Special, so I had a kind of a taste and knew what I was getting into when I got there. But it was great. You know, it was getting there and just the people that come to the backside to see the horses and just the atmosphere and, you know, the way that Maryland just spoils all the people involved, you know, anywhere from the help on up, you know, giving drivers to the owners and enough banquets. And it's just a great experience for anybody in horse racing. And then, you know, they give you big gift bags. It was a fun time. And, you know, I definitely want to be back there. So there's, you know, he gave us a cheap thrill when he made the lead at the top of the stretch. Kind of got run or whatever, but out of that race he's kind of beat up and tired, and we just turned him out and brought him back.
Well, you've come a long way since Bit a Dip in 1990.
Yeah.
Your very first winner. What do you remember about Bit a Dip?
You know, Mandela was great. Let me, you know, when I was still his assistant, he let me claim a couple horses on my own or have a couple outside horses while I was working for him. So I claimed her at Del Mar because we had a real nice filly, you know, Dix, and she'd run for like 40, 50 claiming all the time and win a lot of races. But we always would space out her races every, you know, 4 weeks, and she's kind of a frail thing. And every time we run this filly, Bit a Dip was in against us. But Bit a Dip would run two more times in between this filly start, and she'd always give her a run for the money and the hard trying filly. So at the end of Del Mar, I figured I'm going to claim this filly and freshen her up and wait and just space out a race and see how that turned out. And ended up, my first start, I run second with her, and then I come back and she won a lounge race on New Year's Day. So that was my first win. It's, you know, quite an experience. My father, one of his best friends, owned the horse, so that made it even nicer.
Trainer Mike Machowski, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. Mike, we talked about Cara Cortado, and you mentioned the name Southern Image, who was a very special horse. When you look back at some of the horses that you've had the privilege to be around, I'm sure those two are going to stand out. Who are the ones that you really, really are never going to forget?
I had a horse before Southern Image won the Malibu a couple years before, or a year before. I thought he'd win the Malibu. His name was Pax Takeham. He won a couple lounge races, and then he won a little overnight stake down the hill, and he's at Oak Tree, which was the meet before the Hollywood Farm, and then we'd have Sanita. And I ran him in the overnight stake and down the hill, and he won real impressive, and I just freshened him up trying to do everything right for the Malibu. I really didn't think he'd get beat. He's just doing training good in the way the race was setting up. And down to the business, you know, his blowout before the Malibu, he cracked the pasture and was done. And so that, you know, that kind of was a big damper. And then, you know, so and I thought he was going to be one of those horses that would be very, very special. Another horse we had only ran twice, and they ended up getting a tendon injury, but a major motion picture. You know, Jude's brother was involved in that. He was as good as any horse could be, talented-wise, and just won very impressive his first race at Del Mar, the two-year-old, and then came back and, you know, ended up having a tendon injury, and you know, that was the end. But he was a very talented horse. I mean, it's kind of a shame, you know, you see those horses through your career that don't make it, you know, had all the talent in the world. But that is, once again, that's horse racing that makes it, you know, so great, passionate. It's the ups and downs of having a nice horse and, you know, how they come about.
Yeah, he looked like the real deal. He was pretty exciting, good-looking horse to boot. But
yeah, he was a neat horse. Yeah, your brother still ribs me about it.
Oh, he's so kind.
Mike, you're kind of intertwined into Kentucky Derby history as well. Everybody remembers Mind That Bird and that colossal upset the first Saturday in May, but people forget he was beaten in his prep race for the Derby, the Sunland Derby, and that's probably why he's such a big long shot. But the horse that beat him was a little horse by the name of Kelly Leak.
Yeah, he's a nice little horse. So he wasn't as talented as some of these other ones, but he just peaked at the right time when he won that Sunland Derby. And that was a big time to peak because that was 900,000. But you know, we bought him in Ocala, and you know, a couple of my buddies owned a piece of him, and Blay Hutt, you know, was a longtime client, and one of my buddies, you know, were like fans of the Bad News Bears, and he came up with the name, and I didn't think I'd get it through, you know, with the Jockey Club, and they denied me the first time, so I wrote him a letter, probably I shouldn't say on air what, you know, how I got it approved. But yeah, and then he you know, so if anybody's a fan of the Bad News Bears, they know the character of Kelly Leak in there, and we, you know, that's you know, he ended up being a pretty nice horse. He got DQ'd in the Grade Two he won at Delmar that one year, which I still think was a bad move. The Best Pal.
Well, Mike, you're talk about your family here just a little bit, because if I'm not mistaken, it's all fillies in your house, right?
Yes, it is.
you say that like you're thrilled.
on all sides. I mean, I have four sisters myself, and then my wife has two other sisters and then three half sisters, and then it's all fillies. And a stepdaughter and a couple of daughters.
Are any of them involved in racing?
No, not really. You know, my father-in-law is a veterinarian. And, you know, used to practice on the racetrack, doesn't practice on the racetrack anymore. He has a clinic down the Santa Fe, so he gets a lot of racetrack work. And his name's Joe Cannon. And then, you know, my daughters, they enjoy the horses, but they want to be able to ride them, and that's about it. And it's probably the best thing in the world.
Do any of those fillies like to give you advice on how to train?
Not yet, but they give me advice on other things.
Well, your father-in-law, Joe Cannon, not only is he a veterinarian, but he's one of the world's great veterinarians, in my opinion.
Yes.
And he's a good fella.
Yeah, he's done it all. He's trained also, and you know, run a big farm, you know, for the lumberman,
Aaron Jones.
Aaron Jones. Yeah. And yeah, he's done it all, you know. So he's an all-around horseman himself. And yeah, I bounce things off him too. You know, him and me could sit there and get cynical together once in a while.
Mike, if one of your daughters comes to you and says, "Daddy, I want to be a trainer," what are you going to say?
Go to college. Yeah, go to college. It's a tougher way to make a living. You need to be very lucky and fortunate to have things bounce your way. And you know, you definitely need to. Good clients behind you, and you need a lot of luck and, you know, the horses to peak in the right time and staying sound. It's a tough business. You know, it's, I mean, if you I mean, you got to love it. And if you don't love it, I mean, it makes it even tougher.
Well, they say
I enjoy getting up every morning, going to the barn, and last week out here has been pretty cold, so.
Yeah, they say behind every good man is a good woman, and you have four of them in your household with the three daughters and your wife, Dana. Talk about Dana and what she's meant to you and to your career.
You know, she's been behind me, 13 years now, through it. And with her father being a horse trainer and a veterinarian, being on the racetrack, and she understands it a little bit. It's not an everyday life for a lot of women, I would say, just because not understanding being at work 7 days a week and being at work on Christmas morning if you need to be, because you got horses and opening day at Santa Anita. Being at sales or on the road, so you need somebody who understands it and can put up with the dedication we have towards it and be able to take all the bad moods when you come home at night because your horses run bad or your nicer horse gets sick or hurt or the owner leaves you. There's a lot of things you got to be able to put up with and let it bounce off you, having to deal with roller coaster of being a horse, living with a horse trainer and 7 days a week, 365 days.
Mike, I have a question. Looking at your career statistics, and I don't know if you ever look at your own profile, probably not, but at Equibase we have the profile pages, and you've had such consistency going back all the way to 1995 in terms of percentages, winners, and a great percentage of horses finishing first and second. What do you attribute having so many horses race ready? Is it your experience with Mandela or something you do special that horses really perform? They hit the board a lot more than your average trainer.
I think a lot of it's, working for Richard, patience, running horses, trying to keep them fresh as much, spacing out some races. Especially a race down here in Southern California, we're running a, a tough circuit, and you don't go into a race, it's a walkover, you go in there, you got five guys there. Have live shots in the race, and that's have some real good jockeys out here, so there's a lot of race riding going on, and I think you need a fresh horse to be able to fire and get through that. That's a lot of it.
Is there one jockey that you prefer right now in the current colony?
I try to ride a lot of them, and it makes it easier if you ride some of the top guys, because then you get beat or run poorly, the owners are little understandable, but if there's a lesser jock on, they want to blame the jock or whatever. But, I try to, get, the best guys, or sometimes owners want a guy. And a lot of these guys out here work very hard and come by and work horse in the morning. They pick them out that way, such as Talamo and Bejarano and, Martin Garcia, Martin Pedroza. A lot of guys they work hard, and, that's part of why they have success.
Mike, it's funny, when we visit with so many different trainers on this show, and we have over the past several months, one question that always comes up is the moment that really stands out to them in their career, or the horse that really stands out to them, or whatever it might be. And it's always for a different reason. It might not be the best horse that they ever trained or the one that earned the most money, but it's always some different reason. What's your own personal highlight in the Mike Machowski training career?
A cheap horse I had. Oh, man, what year is that? Early 90s. His name was Sparshot. I could tell you he was just one of those horses that I was able to read. I knew when he was doing good and knew when to scratch him, I knew when not to run him, and it was amazing. And then he was just one of those horses that just he taught you a lot, especially being a young trainer starting out. He got to read a horse, and he taught me a lot just training him. I trained him real light, even though he's a gelding. Some days, just to get him feeling good. And when he started, trying to cow kick you when you walked up to him and things like that, you knew he was ready to go. And, he's a horse that wouldn't run down inside of horses, so I was very careful of that. If I draw down inside, he wouldn't run. If he's outside, he'd be twice the horse. So I learned a lot just from him. Just having a cheaper horse and coming from a guy like Mandela's outfit, we didn't have a lot of those horses.
Can you really get a read on horses like that? I mean, you said that you learned how to read him and you knew him so well. Can you really sense that when you get that kind of relationship with a horse?
There's not every horse has a tail to him, you know, and he did. He was a really neat horse. I could tell when he was going to fire and just when I was even tacking him up in the paddock, you know, the way he acted. He's all business, trying to kick you, doing that, you know, and he's always right there. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And then, you know, some horses, you just tell by the look in their eye, you know, the horse. I'm very keen on how horses look in the eye and how the coat and stuff like that is. And, you know, when a horse's coat's starting to dap wild at the right time and they're doing training good, they're gonna run a big race.
Mike Machowski, our guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train. Mike, about 5 minutes left here before we need to wrap up the show. But what are some of the things that you like to do when you're not at the racetrack? And I know that's a very limited, small time frame, but what are some of the other hobbies that you have and things that you like to do?
I've kind of gotten into golf a little bit lately, but not
game.
As much as I'd like, and not as much as I was, you know, middle of last year. I like working on my own things at the house once in a while. That's about the only free time I get.
yeah, that's exactly right. I know about that. There's not very many hours in the day that you actually get to do something that you enjoy other than training horses. And it's a good thing that horse trainers enjoy training horses because they'd be really surly otherwise. But
are you a pretty good golfer?
No, hacker. I wish I had time to put more into it, but I enjoy it. You know, there were some friends and golfing and just kicking back and relaxing.
Yeah, Kelly Breen said he wants a piece of you.
he plays golf with a friend of mine in New Mexico. He shipped in his barn a few times, Todd Fincher. So that's who I shipped into when Kelly Leak would, you know, won the Sunland race. But he ended up being a really good friend of mine in New Mexico. You know, Kelly ships in there to him and all.
Who do you play with out there? Do you have some other guys around the track that you get out and play with?
Yeah, Nick Casado a lot, and he's probably him the most. He was a jock agent here for a while, and I started another business, and probably from the racetrack, I play with him the most, and then just some friends on the outside, and a couple clients.
Could you beat Talamo? Because he tells me he's pretty good.
You know, I haven't ever played with him, but he's telling me the other day he's been taking lessons with this guy, this pro out of San Gabriel Country Club, and he comes out to the track all the time, so. You know, Joe's pretty talented. We'll see.
Yeah, you'll beat him. Those lessons will kill you. They'll mess you up quicker than anything.
Well, you're telling me.
Breen says he's a six, so he's probably about a three. So.
When they say they're a six, they're a two or three.
Yeah, it's funny. Just bring your wallet. He'll play with you anytime.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Mike, look, we've had a lot of fun with this visit here tonight, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I know Jude and Ellis do as well. It's been great to sit down and talk with you for a little bit, and you've always been great to us, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, buddy. Mike Machowski, our special guest here on Trainer Talk. We'll talk to you soon here, Mike.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Fun stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. All nice those guy, girls. Huh? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he had three daughters and his wife, Dana.
And stepsisters. I know. Oh, my gosh.
He's got a great family. His wife, Dana's sensational gal.
You have a lot of testosterone for living with all them women, I think.
I think that's why you spend so much time at the barn.
Well, you heard him say he doesn't have much time for anything, right? Yeah. He plays a little golf, and then it's the honeydew list around the house.
Well, he's, you know, that's a school. The Mandela School is pretty much, you know, all day working, and Mike has that work ethic in him, and so it's not surprising that. You know, he doesn't have a lot of free time. Most trainers don't. I mean, if you have enough horses to keep you busy, it's a long day.
How many trainers have we asked that question? You know, what else do you do outside of the racetrack and horse racing? And it always kind of stumps them a little bit, and they have to think about it because they just don't. They just, their life is horse racing.
Yeah, well, that's why I used to love Del Mar so much, because it was the one time a year where I could continue to work but still have a little bit of free time, and I would spend time on the beach with the
kids. Except Baffert, who goes in at 9 according to all the tweets we see.
Well, you know, I wouldn't believe that either. Bob gets her before 9. Maybe not before 8, but...
Certainly before 9. Pacific time.
Yeah.
All right, well, it has been a fun show. Our thanks to Kelly Breen and to Mike Machowski for taking the time to visit with us here. A podcast will be available for you on our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, so you can go back and listen at your leisure. Spread the word to all your friends. We're back tomorrow, 3 to 7 Eastern time, our listener call-in show, 6 to 7 Eastern. It's your time to call in tomorrow night. You can visit hrnlive.com for more information and horseracingradio.net. For our producer, Lee Delapina, the Uber Capper Ella Starr, and Jude Feld, the Pontiff, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you tomorrow on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.